ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Helene Alonso, the Director of Digital Experiences at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Her mission has been to transform a traditional institution into one that bursts with activity and engagement. She does this by directing a multidisciplinary team through the design and production of interactive experiences at the museum, focusing on the integration of digital information with the real 3D environment. She's worked on numerous innovative projects involving physical computing, projection mapping, mobile development, including The Enchanted Book, The Cooking Table, Creatures of Light, Flight Like a Pterosaur, and the Theodore Roosevelt Memorial video series. This wealth of new experiences has won awards and been recognized by Apple, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, just to name a few. Helene Alonso, thank you so much for joining today. As the Director of Digital Experiences at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, what does a typical day look like for you?
We have a lot of creative meetings between a lot of very talented people that range from very deep knowledge scientists to makers of details of production in digital, which means like we can be talking about how to make an interactive about, let's say, the brain with a neuroscientist that is a PhD and works, you know, in deep level data sets, and that person is talking to our animators and our programmers to try to make a video game out of it. So our teams are populated by all kinds of disciplines. So the meetings that we constantly have every day, every hour of the day are very creative, very rich, and a big game of, it's like a volleyball game without the net in the middle. The same size. We're just passing that ball constantly.
How big of a challenge is it to take these very complex scientific concepts and ideas? And first of all, I imagine you have to translate them into stories that are understandable by the general public, and then you have to make it engaging. I mean, so can you break down how the process works from a process standpoint? Do you instigate the idea for the exhibit, or how does the process work? How do you go from we're having an exhibit to this is what it looks like? What are the sort of big phases that you go when you're coming up with your creative?
So the first step is to get a subject. And that normally comes from the scientific community here at the museum and the big strategies content-wise by the museum. And as a team, the entire exhibitions team start digging on the content, and that includes the editorial team and us. It is very interesting how diverse the content can be. So there is no way you can ever feel prepared, feel that you know what you're talking about. You are always in the role of the ignorant that has no idea what is this about. Mm-hmm. And so you always feel like you're in fifth grade again. You have to go back to the basics, right? And sometimes you feel a little embarrassed about that ignorance. But once you pass that feeling, it's actually quite useful to embrace your ignorance and look at a new subject with fresh eyes, because that helps you follow the path to understanding. So when I don't understand something, I don't know anything, let's say, about, I remember when we did a show about the brain, and you know some general things about the brain, but there are some neuron connections there that are so abstracted, and what are the neurotransmitters doing? And I'm still already talking about things that I don't fully understand. But once you started asking the right questions and started creating a world of knowledge inside your head, like a structure of knowledge, then you could use that structure to explain it. You know what are the main parts. You know how you got there, so you can make others get there. So the ideas, where the ideas come, I think that the ideas of stories come from the scientists and the editorial department. And once we understand these pieces of content, we translate them into experiences. That is the part that my team and I are stronger at. There are all kinds of experiences in exhibitions, right? So the scenography is one kind of experience. And there are architects and interior designers, industrial designers that do that. Mm-hmm. And we all have ideas for everything, right? but our fortes are our areas. So there is a team that has all the experiences for graphics and make beautiful illustrations and data visualizations and, you know, infographics that bring content to life. And they tend to think more about that, though we do it too sometimes. So when we are talking about digital experiences that are filled with movement and storylines and sound and animations and reactive behaviors, new technologies, illustrations, 3D models, everything that is digital is the team here, my team.
Right. Now, the New York Times wrote a review about an exhibit, and they said that research indicates that the average visitor to even a large exhibition will only spend 20 or 30 minutes looking at everything. How do you design so that you're communicating, but it's going to happen in very short time frames? I mean, do you chunk it up? What's the, in any given part of the exhibit, how much time do you expect a visitor to spend engaged with that piece?
I don't think we put a limit. We have once a piece that was very successful and people spent 20 minutes in it.
That was too long.
That was a bad thing. Very bad thing. What we do is that we provide different layers of information. Mm-hmm. There is the average, maybe 30 minutes, but there are people that are super interested and they spend an hour and a half. And there are people that are like just running around and they're just going to make it 20 minutes because the kids are just running through it or they're tired and they just want to see it quickly. So what we do is that we layer the information in a way that can give you something at every pace. Mm-hmm. So we are highly visual, for example. We know that if you look at an illustration of something, you're going to get a concept, maybe not the details, but you're going to get the concept. Mm-hmm. And if you interact quickly with a movie or if you watch a documentary that is 5 minutes and it gives you the main concepts of the show, you're going to learn a lot in those 5 minutes. So, but also in the exhibition, we have pieces that dive in the content for a longer time. So if you want to understand, let's say, how the brain works or how neurotransmitters work, you can spend there just a longer time digging out. The other thing is that, you know, we have large crowds. So we always provide experiences that can be played by many people. So they spend little time, but they don't have to waste time competing for a place near the experience, right? So they can, many people can go through it at the same time.
Is there an optimal order of the type of experience to have? For instance, is it always better to open with a picture of some sort to set the stage or a documentary so that you immerse people immediately, or those things taken on board more successfully later in the exhibit? I mean, in terms of typically in a museum exhibit, you walk through it. So in some ways it's a linear experience. Is there an optimal way to deliver information, or does it really depend on the subject matter?
It depends on several things. The subject matter, of course, is one of them. The other is the type of gallery that you have. There are galleries that are square, so wherever you enter it is symmetrical, so you can have different paths. There are other ones that are long and narrow, so it has to be linear in another way. So what we try to do is to provide things that can manage the energy level mm-hmm. at the same time than the demand for taking in content. So you're not going to put something that is difficult to understand and complicated to play with. We will never make anything complicated to play with, but that requires more effort and more energy at the end, for example. You're tired already. You already learned a lot of things. You may want to just relax. So we have had things that are a theater that tells you many beautiful things so you can sit down for a little while. Mm-hmm. Or you have a presentation in a theatrical experience where you're going to get to see experiments and things like this. So people can relax, or you put the kind of piazza experience towards the center so people can enter, look at things and sit down and relax for a while while they look at beautiful things that are meaningful. And then you put things that kids can play around. We had an exhibition recently where we put a gigantic insect that kids could climb next to a big movie theater and a bunch of benches. And that was always so crowded. You know, everybody's so tired. And they learned a lot from that movie just because it was in a resting area.
Right, right. Well, it's also interesting because then you have age where you have maybe the older person wants to listen and the child can muck about the giant insect.
That's what I'm saying, that you have to layer for the different kinds of people, for the ages, for the interests, for the levels of energy, and, you know, the types of experiences also that they prefer. Like, there are people that prefer to look at objects, and there are people that love to read every word in the label decks. And there are people that only want to play with interactive things.
Right. How much of a consideration is the robustness of the interface that you use? I mean, you have a certain volume, I imagine, that over the course of time is going to go through an exhibit. So are those things like the robustness of the interface or the ways that people will interact with the exhibit, does that create sort of limitations, creative limitations, which you then have to work within?
Yes, we have to be robust in every sense. They have to be not only strong that they won't fall apart if you play with them, they also have to be robust from in the code, because it's funny how the intensive play with an interactive can bring errors in the program when you hadn't expected, right? It's fast clicking, frequent clicking, clicking in orders that you didn't anticipate. I mean, we try to anticipate as much as possible, and we try the interfaces to be as clear as possible. But there's always some level of exploration of the interfaces that players have that bring up errors in the code that you hadn't expected, right? So when we produce interactives, we make sure that the debugging phase has been very thorough as making sure that the furniture is strong enough to support the weight of whomever is leaning against it. But our exhibits also travel around the world. They are not only here for 8 months, then they travel to other cities in the United States, they travel to other countries and continents, and they can be traveling for like 13 years.
Wow.
So, yes, it's fascinating because also think that, you know, it goes to people of other cultures and get translated, and they sometimes are bilingual. So you have to build everything inside to accommodate different alphabets, different orders for the writing to be. We write from left to right, some write from right to left. Mm. And things like this that we have to consider when we design our interfaces and our codes. And it's particularly complicated when you're trying to mix that with innovation, because in innovative pieces,
of course,
that's not as robust, because there are a lot of new things that haven't been tested. And there are a lot of things that we are creating ourselves. I was thinking the other day that many of the experiences we've done look like not much now. It's like, an app. But that was the first AR app that was like 3 years before anyone else did one, right? But it's not impressive anymore. But when we did it, it was very difficult to make because we were trying to innovate in the fiducial marks, making designs that were going to be now understood, but before they were just squares, and the number of polygons in the three-dimensional models were the maximum that the code could carry in a mobile platform. And I'm not going to start to get too techie here, but what I'm saying is that there are a lot of constraints and challenges when you innovate, and they still have to be robust for all the years that are going to be used, and they still have to be translatable and bilingual and not have bugs.
Do you know, when you're designing it, does every exhibit go on the road, or do only some? I mean, do you know going in which exhibits are going to have to handle that kind of load, or is it something that is determined on the popularity of the exhibit? And as a sort of second part of that question, do you have to adjust things for cultural norms ever, or is it pretty much this is the exhibit and it travels as is?
The exhibits travel as is because they are successful and they are always going out. So it's not that maybe we travel this one, they always travel. And they will always go to places where cultural nuances have to be taken in account. So what we do is that, you know, through the years, we've developed a set of standards that tell us that the most politically correct way to give hierarchies to languages, for example, is to have equal position for each language without differences in hierarchy, for example. Do not give one culture a priority over another culture, right? Things like this that you know that all your pieces must comply with. And, you know, there are also other standards like ADA accessibility for people with hearing impediments or people that need to access your pieces while on a wheelchair. So there are a lot of details that come into these pieces.
Right. Do you think that there are considerations or things you bring to making exhibits and engaging audiences that could be broadly applicable to other forms of entertainment, other media?
Absolutely. Actually, it's exactly the same, to tell you the truth. You know, I work in museums mostly. I also worked in advertising, and my husband works in a big design firm. It is exactly the same. The difference between what we do and what these big other agencies may do for a wider set of product, clients, places, and audiences is that my content is about explaining something that has to be accurate and true. And the goal is to make people understand something. And the understanding goes through emotions, and it goes through fun and gaming and poetry, you know, dreaming, things, fantasy, but it's always understanding something. So I think that in a way, there is more that we share than we don't, but I think that maybe the work that we do at museums may have a different layer of complexity.
I was just going to say it's harder, really. I mean, you know, just because you're dealing with things that are complex and you can't be fast and loose, really. You're held to a higher standard and you have a more complex message you're trying to deliver.
So I don't want to simplify other people's work.
It's also
very complex to make people produce the behavior in people that you want, like make people participate in something, make people visit a place that you want them to place, like have a piece of communication that alters people's behavior is very complex in its own way, right? So I can see that we share this challenge with the other agencies that are trying to, you know, send a message and make people behave in particular ways. It's like, at the end, you know, this is designed for people, and people are just people. And they all understand things in certain ways, and they all react emotionally to certain ways. I mean, not all the same ways, but we've been learning a lot about ourselves.
Right.
It's the same for whatever message you have.
Right. Well, media executives, certainly in the entertainment space, have started to view the competition as anything people can do in their free time. Mm-hmm. And obviously, in some ways, that means they're competing with you because people are choosing to be engaged with the real three-dimensional environment at a museum or stay inside and binge watch, you know, Game of Thrones. So how...
Different audiences, let me just tell you. Because the kids, I hope, are not watching Game of Thrones.
True. So when you're putting together your material and your exhibit, are you also then teaming with the marketing and branding and advertising for the museum to draw people in, or do they just come and leverage your material? I mean, how much are you involved with their discussions outward facing to market?
We are all a big team, and we work together at making the best out of the materials that we have. And we work together at, you know, maximizing them. So we make some things. They take the stuff that we make to make marketing, and we take the ideas of marketing sometimes as part of our exhibitions, as like the posters and all of that. So it is a big team. It's like we've been calling the different teams like the mini team, the macro team, the Uber team. There are so many layers of team, but we do try to be as cohesive as possible in our messages.
Right. So it's a consistent brand. We talk about augmented reality a certain amount on the podcast because that's sort of where things are expanding. And you had mentioned earlier the AR app that you created for the museum, I believe. Was that Beyond Planet Earth? Is that?
Yes.
Was this the first time that your team had made a mobile app?
That was the first time we made a mobile app and the first time that we played with augmented reality. Yes.
Ah, and did you have any challenges other than that it was early days or?
We did. We have big challenges because, you know, the challenges with this kind of experiences start in the theoretical arena. So people start wondering, do we want the teams here, the creative teams start wondering, do we want visitors in the galleries looking at our exhibitions through a phone screen?
Oh.
Do we want competing content in the phone so they are not looking at what is in there?
Oh.
Is the phone a solitary experience that is not shareable? That, you know, that is, you don't go to your entire family looking all together at a tiny screen, right? Does this isolate your teenage kid or whomever is going with you? So we had to make some assumptions, take up some risks and see what happened. Of course, during our process of design, we took in account these concerns. So that's why we went to augmented reality, for example, instead of digital, just mobile content. Because through augmented reality, you needed to see the gallery through the phone in order to activate content. That way it makes you look at the gallery in search for these special spots and activate something. And the models that we created were quite beautiful. They were interactive, they moved, they had parts. So they made you curious about what these things were, and they were interpreted in the exhibition. And we made some things, you know, our attempts at the time to make it playful and shareable. So you could hold the thing and take a picture of you holding a spaceship in your hand or things like this that will allow you to interact with another person you were with.
Right. But I suppose it also allowed them to then take that, repost it, hashtag it, advertise it, and sort of bring this into the zeitgeist of social media and all of that, right?
Yes. And also, you know, we had the question at the time of what happened with those kids that are not allowed to play with cell phones in the gallery or that don't have a cell phone.
Oh. Right?
So we put all of these materials available on the web for printing, and we made a viewer from the web so you could print them at home and then play with them in the classroom or wherever. And you could print them at any size, and then that would make a huge Mars planet next to you or tiny and put it in your hand. So after that, we evaluated it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we studied what happened, and we discovered that it was widely successful, that it did not compete with the exhibition. It actually helped it. And that because it was so much fun and new and captivating, it was memorable. The things they learned there were a lot of things, were easily remembered. So it was a really nice tool to play around with. People share the images. So it worked exactly as we hoped. It was successful. That opened doors.
Yeah. Do you think that this is going to be something that becomes a regular part of what you do in every exhibit or no?
No, we decided to do that once and we didn't do it again for several reasons. One of them is that the market of platforms of cell phones at the time was mostly the iPhone.
Hmm.
But now it has expanded to so many different platforms that you have to create the content in more complex ways. And also then you need to update the content for the different OS systems constantly.
Oh, right.
When you had to update for one OS system, it's one thing. But when you have to update for 20 every year, it starts becoming a maintenance issue. So it's what I'm telling you about the robustness of things.
Right.
Be robust from every perspective. So there are some practical considerations that sometimes don't let an idea go through. But the truth is that we also don't like to repeat ourselves. You know, if visitors come here, we want them to see something new, something they haven't seen before. This is also New York. We are a place where people come to see
it's a tough crowd.
Not only a tough crowd, I mean, think that all the tourists that we have here, all the people that come to New York to dream, and we want them to see the future, to see what's new in the world, not just here or in a particular place. So we try not to repeat ourselves.
Right. Well, one of the Two things I'm curious about. One of the things that media companies are struggling with is engagement from the millennial and digital native population. They have short attention spans, and then they're also they're hesitant to, they won't occlude themselves from their devices. You know, they'll have three devices going at once. Have you found at all that there is a challenge that the population who's coming to the museum, the younger population, has become more challenging to engage? Or when they enter the museum, do they really shed a lot of that and the behaviors are still pretty engaged?
I really don't have solid data to tell you what millennials are doing throughout the museum. But in general, I do see, even in myself, that there is a shorter span of attention. Like every generation that has a cell phone is addicted to it. And I'm addicted to my cell phone. I'm trying to I am. And what we do, what in the media pieces we do, when I was talking about layers, is how to capture the attention faster and what is worth your attention, right? Attention is becoming an expensive gift from your audience, right? So you have to earn it.
That's a great way to think about it, right?
And the way we've been trying to earn that is to communicate the most in the shortest amount of time, which is not speaking faster. Making things more visual and in a design that is so clear that you get it as soon as you see it.
Right.
And if that captures you, you may want to hold that cell phone away from a moment and see what is the second layer of interaction. And the other thing is that it is a human thing that if you can touch it, move it, click it, dial it, experiment with it a little bit with the variables, people are going to play with it. So we try to make them as movable, slidable, animated as possible. So the other thing is that if they can play with it in a full body way, and if it is photogenic, it also not only takes them away from the phone, but makes them
want to document
what they are doing, which is a good thing to some degree, sometimes, not always.
Right. Well, that's interesting. That really is interesting. Now, we have run through our time. It's been a great conversation. But the very last question I'd like to ask you, you're speaking at South by Southwest this year about museums of the future. Can you briefly tell me about that?
Yes, as I told you, we are always wanting to show people what is next. And what is next in the next 5 years, sometimes it's harder to define than what is next in the next 50 years. We are, of course, moving, me and the other awesome ladies are sharing this panel with me, Vivian Trakinski from the museum and Karen Wong from the new museum. We are trying to show the steps that we're taking to meet that future. How are we involving audiences? How we are experimenting with forms of art? How we are adopting new technologies? And how is the experience of museum going to evolve? I mean, we don't know. We are just dreaming, right? So the shortest way I describe this this panel is, it's a science fiction movie that happens in a museum. I want to see, like when I dream, I want to see what I will never get to see because I'll be dead.
That's a sort of horrible thing to say.
What I wish I could have seen.
Oh, that's funny. Well, thank you so much for spending so much time with us and talking us through how you do what you do, how you approach what you do. I think it's really fascinating. And I loved hearing about the way play engages people. We've heard that from other creative people working in other disciplines. And I think that definitely is a piece that people are looking for. I find that really interesting. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped to bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Helene Alonso. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.